Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and family matriarch. And she uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we're all grappling with, especially these days, in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Brad. Happy Healthy Tuesday to you as well.
What's going on? Where are we going? What's on your mind? Talk to me. I'm pins and needles this afternoon.
I have been thinking quite a bit about resilience and how some people seem to just have resilient personalities or temperaments or ways of being in the world. But all of us are capable of developing and honing the skills of resilience when we need them, or if we think we couldn't have them, we can still find them. Resilience is an interesting human skill, I don't know what else to call it, that I think it goes under, you know, we say it, oh, you need to have resilience, or they're so resilient, or, you know, just you'll develop resiliency from tough situations. But we don't really ever talk about what those skill sets are, those things that we need to develop to become more resilient, why it's so important. And, you know, resilience basically is the human ability to adapt in the face of tragedy, trauma, hardship, or ongoing significant life stressors. It's the ability to bounce back. And it's measured by how quickly we're able to bounce back to whatever our new normal is after we go through one of these challenging experiences. And quite often, people will say to me, it's my students or clients or friends, it's like, you seem to be doing okay. Like, why do you seem to just be doing okay all the time? Or, you know, how are you able to look like you've got it all together? It's like, well, part of it is I look like I have it all together. But the other piece is I do feel pretty good. I do seem to have it kind of all together. And I actually feel pretty competent almost all the time. And that comes with age in a lot of ways, but also years of honing those resiliency skills, you know, being able to trust myself and to trust kind of in the universe and to trust that things always tend to work out or get us to a new place. I absolutely am able to confidently say that life is not static. And even when it's so disrupted that we can't imagine it ever getting back to any level of normalcy again, we then find ourselves in a new place that then becomes that new normal. And so maybe all of these years, you know, roaming the planet have given me that sense of inner confidence. I do have that. And I was looking over kind of the skill sets or the definition of resilience. What are those personality traits that people who tend to be resilient have? And I thought it'd be interesting to share them because many of us have these traits and don't even recognize them as being beneficial. And if we don't have these traits, if it's not something that you can just grab at or lean in or have confidence in, they are also skills that you can develop. So personality traits that nurture resilience include an internal locus of control, which means we have this sense of what we can and cannot control, and it lives within us, so we don't feel like everything, we're just reacting to whatever comes at us all the time. So this kind of calm center that we're able to find, the ability to be empathic, curious. Resilient people tend to have a tendency to seek novel experiences. They tend to operate at a high activity level. And I will say, honestly, that's not me. I really like my downtime.
Yeah.
But those who are resilient tend to operate at a high activity level. Resilient people have a flexibility in new situations. They have a sense of humor. They have the ability to elicit positive regard from others. And put an asterisk by that, because that's a really interesting personality trait of resilience. Think about this again. People who are resilient tend to have the ability to elicit positive regard from others. Okay. Those who have resiliency tend to have accurate and positive self-appraisal, which I also like because accurate is honest. We all have things that we'd like to change or improve or could work on in our personality to be able to make an accurate but positive self-appraisal. Resilient people have personal integrity. They have a sense of personal protectiveness. They're able to take pride in their accomplishments and they have a capacity for fun. So even in the darkest of times, those who are resilient are able to find a way to make joy happen. And so when I look at these, going back to the ability to elicit positive regard from others, this is a great parenting skill for parents that are wondering, like, what are the things I need to teach my child so that they can move out into the world with confidence? Or what are things that I should encourage in my teenagers? And of course, what are the things that I should encourage in myself? But as a parenting tip, we overlook the importance of helping our children learn to be a joy to be with and of service to others. You know, we tend to want to make sure that the world is fair to our child. We want to make sure that our children have access to all opportunities. We want to make sure that they are able to learn and to grow and to thrive and feel accepted and loved. But also, we need to help our children understand that they are not the center of the universe and that they are part of a collective. And being part of a collective means that we need to be of value to and of service to the rest of the community. And when we're able to be helpful and polite and able to think about others and to ask questions and develop that sense of empathy, we are able to elicit positive regard from other people. We become someone that others want to be around. And that's an invaluable trait for kids that are in school, especially in busy, busy classrooms where teachers are, you know, trying to manage a lot of things. If your child knows how to be helpful, to elicit positive regard from their teacher, to be of service, they tend to get a better education because they're getting that attention, and that attention, that positive attention helps to build their self-esteem, which then all of this grows and builds on each other. So I think the takeaway from this list is the ability to elicit positive regard from others is a great skill for all of us to work on, especially when it's so easy to have things blow up.
Right.
And to flare up and to be at odds with each other, or it's easy to be prickly. And, you know, we tend to confuse in our social dynamic assertive behaviors and aggressive behaviors. You know, quite often people think they're being assertive, but it's really they're coming off as aggressive. They might think they're just being passionate about something, but it really becomes off-putting. And so what is that fine line between being assertive, speaking about the things you're invested in, being able to talk about the things that matter to you in a way that don't turn people, that people are able to listen to you and to feel comfortable with the story. Maybe not totally comfortable, but they're willing to listen because that assertiveness, that confidence is compelling to listen to, but it doesn't make people feel defensive. It doesn't make them feel less than. It doesn't make them feel threatened. And so, again, that ability to elicit positive regard from others is a central piece of resilience, because when all else fails, if everything crumbles around us, if we've been told no in every aspect of our life, if we are the kind of person that's able to elicit that positive regard, to get people to feel like they want to help us or they want to spend time with us, that's going to open doors for rebuilding opportunities then to help us move our life forward. And so that's the hot tip from the list of personality traits that nurture resilience. And then also, you know, that ability to seek novel experiences, to still look for the joy and awe in life, even when things are dark and feel heavy and we wonder how we're going to go forward. And then that sense of pride in our accomplishments, to be able to acknowledge, you know, I put some effort into this. I really did. And I feel good that I was able to accomplish this event or this experience or this class or this project, whatever that is. And when we build on that ability to know that our accomplishments are of value and that we can feel good, it again builds those building blocks to help us bounce back or into that new place of normal. And I say that new place of normal because when we've had setbacks, when we go through traumatic times or significant life stressors, we have this hope and fantasy that we're going to bounce back to normal, that place we were before this event happened. But that's not really ever possible. Everything that we experience in life changes us on some really profound level. And so part of the bounce back, part of the resilience is being able to also accept those things that we can't change and to be able to accept that when we do bounce back, we will be different. We'll be stronger. We'll be different. will be more aware, will be different, and will be more capable of dealing with whatever life hands us next. So that's what's on my mind today. And it flows nicely with my guest, who has flown in to the area from San Diego. It was one of those best laid plans that actually worked out that we were able to get Lauren Marie Fleming here on time to be part of the show, because she's in town to hold an interactive workshop up at Cal Poly this evening from 6 to 7 p.m. that's open to the public. It's a free interactive workshop. The title of the workshop is Transform Rejection into Resilience and Creative Success. And it's going to be happening up on campus in the left wing of the Chumash Auditorium building. As I said, it's open to the public. I highly recommend going. It'd be great for teenagers and their parents to go because Lauren Marie Fleming is on fire.
I can't wait to hear our conversation with her today.
I am too. Lauren Marie Fleming is a writer and a coach, helping people discover their story and tell it to the world. Her most recent book, all of a sudden I lost my pace, because Fat Girl was published in October, and she's kind of changing not only her own life, but the narrative of others every day in her workshops that she does all over the country, but also in her own business, School for Writers, to help people kind of get off their typewriter and actually make something happen. So Lauren Marie Fleming is our guest today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you can be part of the conversation by sending me an email after the show to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also follow me on Instagram, Facebook, leave a message there as well. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcast our show wherever it is you find your podcast. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, leave a review, and you'll be able to listen at your convenience and share it with others as well. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and get started with our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I never held my hand up and asked for something free. I got pride I could roll up for miles in front of me. I don't need your help, and I don't need sympathy. I don't need you to lower the bar for me. I know I'm superwoman, I know I'm strong. I know I've got this, cause I've had it all along. I'm phenomenal, and I'm enough. I don't need you to tell me who to be. Can someone just hold me? Don't fix me. Don't try to change a thing. Can someone just know me? 'Cause underneath, I'm broken and it's beautiful. I'm broken and it's beautiful. I'm broken and it's beautiful. I'm broken and it's beautiful.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Welcome, Lauren, to the show.
Hello. It's so exciting to be here. I made it just in time. Just flew in.
I know. It's amazing. So Lauren and I talked on the phone this weekend about the workshop that she's doing up at Cal Poly tonight from 6 to 7 p.m. I said, well, it would be so fun to have you in the studio just to talk about your life, but also to be able to promote this activity, this interactive workshop.
Yeah, it's tomorrow night. It's Wednesday night.
Oh, thank you for correcting me.
Yeah, it's Wednesday night.
Thank you. That's even better.
That's even better. It gives people a little bit more time to plan.
I know. Tomorrow night, Wednesday evening. It also helps my students be able to go see it after class. Wednesday night, tomorrow night, 6 to 7 p.m. at the Chumash. But I said it would be so exciting to have you in the studio. She's like, yeah, I'm flying in at 1:30.
1:35.
1:35, we're going to be exact. And I said, I think we can make that happen. And what are the odds? It actually does work. So, and even in the storm and... Yay.
We were supposed to have this conversation, and you all were supposed to hear it.
So we were supposed to be able to get together. So let me introduce you again. Lauren Marie Fleming is a writer and coach, helping people discover their story and tell it to the world. Her company, School for Writers, helps aspiring authors write their books in a way that harnesses the transformational power of storytelling. In her 20 years as a professional writer, Lauren has written multiple books, been featured in prominent publications including Vice, The Huff Post, and has spoken at prestigious conferences and colleges including Yale and Brown.
Yeah.
But
and now Cal Poly.
And now it'll be Cal Poly, another prestigious university. And part of your kind of personal and professional experience that kind of shaped where you got there, part of your work was 2 years directly supporting Tony Robbins and coaching the speakers on stage. Can't wait to hear about that. Must have been exciting. And then starting a critically acclaimed Queer Bradshaw blog.
Queery Bradshaw.
I love that.
So like Carrie Bradshaw, but for queer people.
Yeah. Yes, I was very... totally clever, which was one of the first lesbian sex focused websites on the internet. You wrote your law school thesis on queer pornography because you also have a law degree on top of your 20 years of professional writing. You spent years traveling, living in Italy, Mexico, Czech Republic. I'm not even sure where to start, but
I'm impressed you got all of that.
I just kept going through, well, because also if you get a chance, Lauren's website is so much fun. It's like going into a carnival. It's the colors and the vibrancy of it. It was just, I read everything that you had on there. So Lauren, how did you, let's start with the basic things. How did you create this place that you are today? What was the journey that you took to get here? Where are you from?
I'm from a small farming town called Brawley the Mexico and border in California. So my parents' house is about 60 miles, I think, north of the border. And it was, I'm, you know, fourth generation landowner. My great grandparents left me some land that is still farmed by a local farmer. And my dad, until about a year ago, was a farmer, and all his siblings were farmers and were just farm people. And that was an interesting experience to grow up in a conservative farming town as an openly queer kid. And as somebody who was fat and awkward and weird and definitely did not fit into what I thought I needed to do to fit in there. And yet, there were these beautiful pockets of creativity, of people that I saw still making art in that community. My grandfather was a farmer, and he had a whole second career as an artist. He lived till he was 93 and painted until the week he died. And I sat in the studio with him and painted with him. And so on one hand, I had these people that were, you know, saying that people like me don't deserve to exist and that we're wrong and we're sinners and we're bad. And then I had people telling me, you know, you got to go out there and work really hard on the fields. And that's true God's work right there, the salt of the earth work. And then I also had people that were showing me that the arts mattered and the arts were important and the arts were healing and the arts were therapeutic and the arts were something worth carving out time for. And my grandpa had a whole room in his house. They moved into a bigger house so we could have a whole room to paint. Right? And what does that mean to bridge that world? It was a world of immigrants. It was a world, a town with 90% Mexican and, you know, Spanish all around me. Mariachi as much as country could be blaring out of the cars going by. Lowriders and high lifted trucks were the same. And I think that always left the impression of crossing borders, of bridging gaps, of being an in-between that can go through these different things. There's no binaries in my life. And I think that made it so when I went out into the world and started exploring, I was always holding two truths at once, holding multiple truths at once, not trying to be either or, left or right. And so, of course, I have an undergrad in film and a law degree. Of course, when I was in law school, I did two theses. Of course, I couldn't decide. And for so long, I beat myself up because I couldn't just decide whether I wanted to be a business person or whether I wanted to be a writer. And I was like, what does it look like to hold those together? Mm-hmm. And what that really looks like is resilience and perseverance. Because if you're not following the established path and you're not fitting into the sides that they want you to fit into, it can be really hard. Mm-hmm. And so that is why I now talk about the thing that is the through line through it all is creativity and writing. And the thing that has gotten me to where I am is perseverance.
When you were young, how did you discover your love of writing and storytelling? How was that nurtured in you?
one of my first memories. So I have two memories that I don't know which one is my very, very first. Mm-hmm. Either the day my dad came home to my grandma's house where I was staying and told me I had a little brother, or the day my dad came home and I ran to him with a crown in my hand to show I can write my name. Mm-hmm. And those are the two memories. I don't know which one was first, but I think that they influence a lot of who I am, like family and writing and wanting to share my writing with others and being excited about my family. And so I think that I started writing at such a young age, it just is in my bones. And I absolutely lost the train of thought because I was thinking about those two memories. They're so vivid in my mind, mm-hmm. and how they influence me. So I forgot my...
Well, that's why they came back. Sorry. Well, I was just curious because... Although your grandfather was a painter, where was nurturing? Did you go to public school? You know, was it a teacher that said you can do this? What influenced you to, you know, go to film school? Because that seems like a pretty large leap from Brawley, California to film school.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, I wanted to be a marine biologist because I thought that they got to swim with dolphins. And so okay. I begged my parents to send me to marine biology camp. And I went to marine biology camp. And I had the horrible realization that marine biologists were scientists.
Yes.
And so I was like, who gets to swim with dolphins then? Because I want to be whatever that person is. And somebody told me, well, only the rich and famous swim with dolphins. I was like, okay, cool. I want to be rich and famous then, okay. so I can swim with dolphins. And that put a seed in my head of like, what would it look like to actually be on a public stage? And is that something I could do? Is that something I'd want to do? And so I think film school came from this idea of wanting my stories to be seen by rooms full of people, mm. and wanting to be the person that somebody could also turn on the movies and find comfort in it. When I was 12, my dad was diagnosed with cancer and my parents left for 6 months as he got treatment in LA. And I just watched the same movies on nonstop repeat over and over and over again. And I was like, what if I could be this for somebody else? Mm. What if I could be the soothing person? I went to film school and everybody around me was like, my favorite movie is this Tarantino film or this Hitchcock film or this random French movie nobody's ever heard of, but I look cool when I say it. And I was like, the Santa Claus? Because right. I had a really hard time when I was 12 and the Santa Claus got me through. And so I like to write accessible commercial hits with deep understanding because that's what I needed. Mm-hmm. I needed not the avant-garde film, although I do love, like, Cinema Paradiso is one of my favorite films. I do love avant-garde. I went to Italy for a year to study Italian neorealistic film. Like, I can be a snob. But what really comes down to it is what is actually accessible to us to tap into our emotions that we need. Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Lauren Marie Fleming. She is a writer, storyteller, author, because Fat Girl, which was just published in October, so you've been on a whirlwind since then.
It's
and we're kind of catching up to how you got to the place where you're offering a workshop tomorrow night up at Cal Poly and also publishing this book. So you went to film school, but as I mentioned earlier, you also have a law degree, so film school clearly didn't get you exactly where you wanted to be.
I think I had people during film school, whether they were right in this advice or not is debatable, but they said, there's no way you'll make it in Hollywood. There's okay. no way you'll make it in Hollywood because it's hard. There's no way you'll make it in Hollywood because they're mean to fat people. There's no way you'll make it in Hollywood because they are not nice to lesbians. You're just not going to make it in Hollywood. So try to get in the back door. And I had a professor who was like, the back door is novel writing. Mm-hmm. And so I decided I was going to go get an MFA in writing. And I went to go apply to an MFA in writing. And they have this horrible realization that you have to do math to get in. Why would I have to do math? But you have to pass the GRE.
Yeah.
And I could not pass the GRE. And I went back for my third practice book to try to learn how to do the GRE. And next to it was an LSAT book. And I was like, screw it. I'm going to law school. I would look cute in power suits. And it started as a joke again, like the how can I be rich and famous? It started as a joke. And then it wormed its way in my brain. And I talked to my professor, who was Professor Joseph McBride at SFSU, was a mentor of mine in my career. And he was like, you know what? That's actually great. Go to school for what you want to write about, mm-hmm. not for writing. You're a great writer. You don't need another degree in writing. You need a degree in something else. And I think I use my law degree every day. It taught me the left brain. It was that right brain, left brain. And it mm-hmm. allowed me to really understand arguments and logic and doing research and working your butt off to get to the answer you're looking for, to find that one golden nugget that could help prove your point. And it was really beautiful. Hilariously, I was horrible at legal writing. Okay. But because you have to use the same words over and over again, and there's a specific formula, and I didn't like it. But I took my law degree and became an activist writer for many years afterwards. I used my law degree to make an impact in the world through writing columns in various different places, Huffington Post, Vice, Curve, Nerve, like all these places that were huge. And I think that is one of the best things I ever did for my writing career, was not get an MFA in writing, but was to get a law degree so I could learn to write in a different way.
And as you mentioned earlier, you didn't have kind of this binary way of wanting to approach the world, that you had two specialties coming out of law school, two passions. So what were they?
So I did a thesis on cross-border mobilization and what it can teach in the European Union and what it can teach the North American Free Trade Agreement. And it was a breakdown of the legal arguments for why free trade across borders is actually extremely beneficial for usually the richer country, but for both countries, and how as somebody who grew up watching labor cross every day, watching goods cross every day, I saw the direct positive impact that the movement across borders had. And so it was an argument using the information that was coming out of the EU from after they had opened their borders to cross-border mobilization of labor and of goods in the North American Free Trade Agreement, which we were currently at that time trying to end, and are currently again trying to end. And I'm a huge advocate of allowing the free movement of people and goods across the border, because I grew up seeing the positive impact that it can have on a community culturally, economically, personally.
And then the other voice that she brought to the surface was what?
Was a very different topic.
Yes.
So it was on obscenity laws, and specifically queer pornography, and the way that obscenity laws are used to really break down and make illegal a lot of queer art, a lot of queer stories. It's, obscenity laws are the base of book bans. Right now they're trying to pass an obscenity law in Oklahoma where anything obscene, the writer could be put in jail. So one of the examples they keep using is the erotica novel that's huge right now, Fourth Wing. If this passed, Rebecca Yarros could be put in jail for anybody who read her book. Not just kids, anybody.
Anyone. Wow.
And so the way that obscenity laws trickle down and the effect that it has is far beyond. And it's almost always exclusively used against people from marginalized communities. For example, one of the obscenity laws cases that I studied was a company that had images of a black man and a white woman. And that is anything interracial is unacceptable. It's obscene. And the things that you would have, like two gay men kissing, obscene. But you could have horrifically depictions if it was straight, but not if it was gay. And there was just so much hypocrisy in it. And so much of it was, I know it when I see it. And so much of it was these men in power would literally watch porn and decide if the Supreme Court went to the basement and watched it to decide if it was obscene or not. And I heard that and I was like, well, this is my thesis topic. Whatever that is, that's hilarious. And it tells us so much about how we think about culture and how we try to regulate what people are thinking and feeling and doing, and how we use For the Children to be our justification. But it was never about the kids. It was always about control. And again,
both things are about control, aren't
they? Exactly. Both things are about control. And again, it's not like we're looking at anything that actually harms anybody. Everybody's consensual. Everybody's paid. Like, it's not like we're, looking at labor laws. That's a whole different thing. We're just looking at somebody found this to be obscene and now you have to go to jail because they were offended by it.
And so you have these two, you'd think dichotomous, but really they are connected. They're about control and controlling those who don't have power in a society that wants to pretend like everyone is free. Fascinating. How did then those steps lead you to working with, I don't know if that was the next piece of it, you working with Tony Robbins for 2 years and kind of helping him, but also elevating your own ability to coach others and elevate your voice. Was that the process?
Yeah. So I had, after law school, I ran my own writing company for a couple of years, but I really felt like I lacked the know how to fully be an entrepreneur. I had studied the law. I had studied writing. I was really good at what I did, but I didn't understand pricing. I didn't understand everything. And I was just, I was not floundering, but I was really, I was barely making ends meet. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I wanted to get to the next level, I was like, okay, well, maybe I go back and get an MBA or something.
Right.
What do I do? How do I learn about business? How do I learn about marketing? How do I learn about any of this? And it just happened as kismet does. I got a message from a headhunter, and they said that the Robbins Research Institute was looking for a creative content producer. Would I be interested in the role? And I said, I have no idea who Tony Robbins is.
That's even better.
I knew him as, but I did know him as a business person, because the time I had seen him was this woman, Marie Forleo, that I followed for business advice, had had him on to talk about business. And so I was like, okay, so he's like a big business guy. And hilariously enough, when I published my book, Body Love, 10 Steps to Profoundly Loving My Body, my dad was like, what is this? You're in, like, your self-help? Are you going to be like one of those? Don't be like Tony Robbins, whatever you do. And I was like, I don't know who that is, but whatever. And then I was like, hey, Dad, remember that guy you told me not to be like? Well, I am going to be paid to travel the world with him now. And I was his right-hand content producer and for these big events that he would do all over the world. I was one of a team of about four, depending on what time it was, like anywhere from 3 to 5 of us. And we would travel around with him, and we had to know his content like the back of our hands. Mm-hmm. And we had to help him come up with other content. We would prep him before he went on stage, talk with him afterwards on how it went, and then stay, make sure the rest of the speakers were as high quality. And I just got a reputation for being great at story coaching. So I started coaching all the speakers on his stage and working with them to get their stories better. And, you know, it worked. It was really great. I thrived. I loved it. Mm. And then I was sitting on an island in Fiji surrounded by people who did something similar to what I had done before I worked with him. And I was just like, I think it's time to go back to being my own boss. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed working for him. He was a very kind person who obviously cared about his staff. And I was also just like, I got to be on that stage myself. Mm-hmm. And so I quit in February 2020 with the idea that I was going to still go to events with him. I just wouldn't be full time. And then March 2020 happened, and they didn't need people at events anymore. And I went full time into my business school for writers, which I don't regret at all. I miss, you know, traveling on the world, but I love, love, love what I do now. And it's so great to get to be. I love coaching people and helping them find their voice, but I'm pretty adamant that I don't like to give my voice to others to use. And that's why I liked working with Tony, because he has such a strong voice. But it was starting to feel like with some of the other speakers, I was like giving them the words to use, and I wanted to do my own speaking.
Yeah, your voice, finding your place.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to my guest, Lauren Marie Fleming, who is a writer, author, story coach, and founder of School for Writers. And we're going to take a quick break, kind of recalibrate ourselves, and come back and continue this conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
She's just a girl and she's on fire, hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire, filled with catastrophe, but she knows she can fly away. Oh, she got both feet on the ground and she's burning it down. Oh, she got her head in the clouds and she's not backing down. This girl is on fire.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm with Lauren Marie Fleming. This girl is truly on fire. just kind of talking about how you got to where you are today. There's so much more that goes into it as well, but just that kind of run up, it seems like from the time you were little, you set an intention. You used the word seed. You set an intention and you're able to kind of nurture it and bring it to fruition. And I would imagine that has something to do with your success as a storyteller and as a story coach.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting to be 42 and in a studio and on a media tour for a book and be talking about all this great success I've had. And you don't talk about how a year and a half before my book came out, I was on the floor crying to my friend who's here in the studio with me because the agent told me no one was going to buy it and no one would ever buy it. And none of my other stories were going to sell either, right? It's so amazing to know that watering the seeds can pay off, but it might be like 20 years after you think it is.
Right. Our timeline is our own internal wish, right? But the universal timeline is usually something else.
Yeah. My book came out 20 years after I started writing my first novel and 7 years after I wrote this one and 5 years after I had started pitching it to agents and publishers. And so I tell people that it can, I think in this age of TikTok, especially if you're a creative, you see all these people who are overnight successes. They go viral and suddenly they're overnight successes. Nobody is an overnight success. Nobody. Even people who go viral once, if they sustain it, it's because they've been doing it forever, right? They're making a video five times a day, right? Things like that. They have the tools. And so I like to think of it as watering a seed. You got to start with the crap. You got to start with crap because then you have the compost in there. And that's what you, and you like plant the seeds and you water the seeds and you see what grows. And whatever grows, just keep watering it or weed it. I had to let go of a lot of things in my life. I had to let go of the amazing Tony Robbins job. I had to let go of being a lawyer. I had to let go of being a film director. There were things I had to let go of. There are things I'm picking back up. I'm you know, want to still direct films. I'm still working on it. But some things you just have to let go and focus. And I think for me, I always try to think of, I hate stories. Ugh, I hate a story that nothing happens. You don't want a story where nothing happens to the person, unless it's a ridiculous farce where everything, only good things happen, and then it's hilarious, and that could be funny. Only good things ever. But when people are so sad that sadness happens and hurt happens and grief happens, and let me tell you, I have been through it. Ooh, I have been through it. Those are the dark night of the soul. Those are the belly of the beast. Those are the moments that we live for. And then the good comes afterwards. Then it happens. And I'm not saying bad things are great because you should go out and try to find bad things, but you should absolutely go out and have adventures. Get lost, because that's where the nuggets of excitement come from, not the perfect story and the perfect path followed.
You mentioned in your website, you know, some of the personal and professional experiences that kind of shaped who you are today. And I mentioned kind of living abroad and working for Tony. But also you had four family members who struggled with cancer, and then you lost your brother. And I think it's okay to bring it up because it's on your website, but this was a profound part of your growth, or really maybe taking charge of nurturing your seeds.
Yeah, I think there's no way to watch your younger brother, who was vibrant and alive and strong and just in the peak of his youth, die of a horrible cancer and not be like, well, what the hell am I going to do with my life?
Right, right.
And then, so there was, my grandmother had a stroke at my law school graduation and died. My brother,
at the graduation.
Oh my goodness. She had the stroke at the graduation. She died 10 days later in the hospital. While I sat with her the whole time, because we were miles away from any other family, and family came up, but you know, it was me and her. And we'd had a complicated relationship. She loved me dearly, but she didn't always get me. And she was always there supporting and cheering me on, even if she was like, I don't know what you're doing with your life, but I'm in here. And so it was a beautiful, you know, of course it had to be, it was at mine. And then my brother was dying of cancer, and he died. And in this way that we had we knew his cancer was rough, but he had come home and he died in a way that was really violent. And I had PTSD from it for a long time. I could barely function. And then a month after he died, I held my grandpa's hand as he died. And it's impossible to just face that. And through all of this, my sister also had a premature baby and they both almost died. She was like, it was just one after another, after another, after another, after another, after another. My partner left me, like it was one after another until I had nothing left.
No reserves.
And nothing left.
Yeah.
And I always say that was the best moment of my life. And it is so, I never want to emotionally bypass people. If you had told me like this too shall pass, or God doesn't give you more than you can handle, any of those horrible things, I would have punched you in the face and told you to go F off. Mm-hmm. My brother's death was the absolute worst thing. That was the worst thing in the world. And I wouldn't be the person I am right now if it hadn't happened.
But you can only appreciate that, I would imagine, right now.
10 years later. Mm-hmm. Don't ever tell somebody that when they're in it. Mm-hmm. And it will never feel that way when you're in it.
No.
But 2 years later, I had a full nervous breakdown. And I dealt with everything I'd been not dealing with for 30 years of my life in my family. We all went to therapy. Parents that said they'd never go to therapy went to therapy because we had nothing. Right. We had nothing left. We couldn't hide anymore. And there's a beauty in that. And I think that I am the writer I am because I know what it's like to have nothing left. And I know that I'm inspiring in how I lived my life because of the hard things I went through. And so I think it's important to remind people that I've had the, you know, on the floor crying, not doing okay moments, really, really wondering if I'd make it through the night. Call in the suicide hotline. By the way, you don't even have to call them. You can just go to their website. I never could get myself to call them, but I tell people all the time, if you're having a rough time and you could never call, go to their website. Their website saved me. Texting on their website has saved my life.
I was going to say texting is available.
Texting on their website saved my life. And I always thought I wasn't in too bad of a shape to be there. And every time I did, I was glad I called them. I messaged them. So I tell people that, like, there have been hard times. And that is what makes the story better.
Wait, what freed you to write this story? What made Because Fat Girl a better novel?
So I wrote Because Fat Girl because I had gone to Mexico on a writing retreat to finish my very important and very serious book about grief.
Okay.
And my hometown. It was very important and very serious. And it was going to be like very, very important and very serious. And I say that because I went there and I was almost done with it and I had to get it to my agent. And I was like, okay, now it's time to be serious. And then I kept having this dream that The Rock wanted to date me and I turned him down. And that was not a serious dream.
No.
And it was not. It was so hilarious. And I was laughing so hard. And I was like, okay, well, you can't write about that. That's not serious. Like, you got to write about serious and stuff. And every time I go to write, I kept writing the story about The Rock wanting to date me and me turning him down. And it was fun and it was lighthearted and it was so very far from what I thought I needed to write to get through my grief. And it actually ended up being the exact thing I needed. I was in this place where I didn't feel like I could ever find love again. I didn't think I'd get my career back again. I did not know what a happily ever after could look like to me. Mm-hmm. And I am queer and I have never dated a man and I can't imagine dating The Rock, but if there was going to be somebody that I was like, there's no way in hell I could get someone like that, it would be The Rock. And I was like, what would it look like if I just said, okay, I'm going to date The Rock and win an Oscar and da-da-da, what would it look like? And I wrote The Happily Ever After for that. Mm. And suddenly I found myself being like, well, if I could do it in fiction, can I do it in my real life? Mm-hmm. And that kickstarted my career. That kickstarted my getting back out there dating. It kickstarted me writing movies again. It just changed things in my life, seeing it in fiction first. And so now I tell people, if you want to write something really serious, you want to write something really hard, you want to try something really rough, write something where you're giving yourself a happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's hard, that's serious, and that's important, and that's rough.
Because in some ways it's almost more vulnerable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
because you're sharing your hopes.
Well, and how dare I, right, a lesbian, think that she could get The Rock? Like Dwayne The Rock Johnson, right? Like, there was so much. How could I think that I could come back and, like, win an Oscar? Like, people are like, this is so unrealistic. I'm like, is it? I could show you 5 stories in Hollywood that this has happened in real life.
So
and also,
why
who
not?
Cares if it's not realistic? It got people hoping that they could tell their stories, too.
Mm-hmm. Because Fat Girl was published in October 24, so just a few months ago. So you are still in the midst of this book tour. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Lauren Marie Fleming, author, story coach, storyteller, founder and owner of School for Writers. And Lauren's here in town visiting a friend, best friend, but also is going to be hosting, or I guess holding a workshop tomorrow night, Wednesday evening, from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Chumash Auditorium at Cal Poly. It's open to the public, encouraging people to come. I had mentioned that it might be great for teenagers to come to this workshop to kind of get inspired. It's from 6 to 7. I don't know if people need reservations or they can just show up, but it's the left wing of the Chumash Auditorium. So let's talk about School for Writers and the topic of your interactive workshop, which is Transform Rejection into Resilience and Creative Success. How did this come to be?
I realized that my fear of rejection was really holding me back, and I was trying to come up with a way to make it exciting and make it interesting. And I thought about times in which I did things for rewards. I have ADHD. I have to have a reward built in or I'm never going to do it. So I made myself a sticker chart, and I thought about how I just needed somebody to tell me I did good and give me a gold star. And so I was putting myself out there, facing rejection, trying to get people to work with me. I wanted to buy a condo that I had fallen in love with, and I was like, I need to make more money to get this. Like, how do I do this? And so I just told myself I was going to reach out to 100 people and face 100 rejections until I got what I needed. And I got to about 32. My goal was to make $10,000. At 32, I had $16,000 in the bank and $80,000 in clients' contracts.
So what were you reaching out for? Were they agents or were they clients?
They were clients. So potential I was just clients. Reaching out to random people that I knew and be like, how would you want to work with me? Want to work with me? How? I've got this program, but also like, well, how do you want to work with me? Right. And this was, I had promoted some things in my business, but I hadn't really gotten the thing yet that was really working. School for Writers existed.
Okay.
But I was, I just hadn't figured out how to make it quite monetize it yet. I had my Write Your Friggin' Book Already program, which I love, but it only opened once a year. I was just looking for like, what are people? And I had this idea in my mind that everybody wanted me to teach them how to make money writing. And yet I wasn't doing it myself, right? And so I just reached out to people. I was like, if you were going to work with me, what would you want to do? Do you want to work with me? What would you want to do? And my accountant ended up hiring me to help her start telling her story on a YouTube channel because she wanted to share her experience. I had somebody that knew me from some other thing reach out to me, be like, hey, can we do a weekend together where we just like work on my book together? It was things I hadn't even thought of. And suddenly I had an influx of clients. And I don't offer a lot of those services anymore, but it was just my way of what would it look like to not be afraid of rejection? Mm. And since then, I call this 33 asks because every time I've done it, around the number 33 is when I hit my goal. And sometimes earlier, but I've never had to go past 33 and not hit my goal or had a moment where I'm like, okay, this isn't the right thing then. If 33 people,
you're not there.
Nobody's interested, right. something needs tweaking. Mm-hmm. And I tell the story a lot about I used this to get my agents. I told myself I was going to do 13. And at 13, I had only rejections. At 13, I got a quite painful rejection that was really offensive, actually. And I sat down and cried. And I was like, wait, Lauren, you don't stop at 13. You stop 33. At 33. And I stopped at 22 because I had 8 agent offers by that time. It's just a matter of not stopping at 13.
Right,
or not even stopping at 33, right? Like sometimes you got to do the next round of 33 or adjust your pitch and then go again. And it just made me realize that the difference really is letting go of a fear of rejection. And I'm not just talking financial success, right? Mm-hmm. Like it has changed. When my book came out, I invited everybody I knew to come to an event because I wanted to have my events full of people I loved. Mm-hmm. But I probably wouldn't have done that if I hadn't gotten used to asking for what I want in my life. I'm dating again. I have a much better sex life now. Just learning to ask for what I want and understand that the ask needs to be mutually beneficial. It needs to be aligned with what I actually want, not what I think I want. It needs to be aligned to my legacy. It needs to be fun and rewarding to do this. That's why I have sticker charts. That's why I use colored pencils. Mm-hmm. That's why I make it fun. Some people make charts that I work with, like make a whole spreadsheet. They love spreadsheets. They make a chart, a graph. And then you got to make it rewarding. You have to build in the rewards. That's why the stickers feel good to me to put on chart. And at the end, I always reward myself with something like a dinner out, or I go right in a cafe that I've never been to before or something, some kind of rewarding. So you got to make it fun. You've got to connect it to your legacy, to why you even care. And, yeah. And then you've got to make it rewarding. And if you do those three things, you will build up resilience to rejection, because it doesn't matter if that agent says no. Because it just wasn't right for that agent. Mm-hmm. I learned that it doesn't matter if I ask that person out and they say no, because I'm just not right for that person. It's not personal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it has changed my life, and it's changed my business, and it's changed my career.
So then, in order to reach some level of success, rejection, being Teflon to rejection seems to be at the heart of it?
Yeah. What if I came in here and I was like, listen, so I wrote a book. It was great. It was great, the first draft. And then I got an agent, and mm-hmm. that was great. That experience was great. The first agent I asked, they were the person. And then I got a publisher, and it was great. And then it became a New York Times bestseller. It was great. It was so great. There was nothing. There was no moment of rejection. Like, that's not a fun story.
Right. That's our 5-minute interview. Thank you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I'm also not a fun person. You get really obnoxious if you're – I've met people who were overnight – not overnight successes, but were people who got, like, the quick luck hit. And, you know, 5 years later, they're pretty miserable.
Yeah.
They're pretty
because
miserable.
Because they're not reaching for anything.
Yeah, you get it. I tell you, I've been reaching for years for my book to be out, and now I'm like, now what? You know,
gratification. That was my next question.
Gratification happens real quick. Luckily, yeah. I have overcome so much rejection to get here that I've learned that you have to appreciate the wins. So I am just sitting in the win of good. This. I'm sitting in the win of it. I'm
marinating.
Sitting, marinating mm-hmm. in the dream come true. Mm-hmm. As my brother died, I had this out-of-body experience mm-hmm. where everything that mattered became – I was like floating through the universe, and everything that mattered was this bright star mm-hmm. and everything that didn't just faded into black. Mm-hmm. And this was my North Star, and I'm sitting on my North Star right now. And my instinct is to try to find the next North Star so I can run to that.
Right.
And instead, I'm very lucky to be surrounded by people reminding me to just – like, you made it, Lauren. Mm-hmm. You worked 20 years to get here. You made it. Enjoy having made it. Before you even have to start thinking about what's next, enjoy having made it. I know what's next. I'm going to keep telling stories. I'm going to do the same thing I did when I was rejected. But what stories, how, in what way do I ever want to publish again? I don't know. Mm. But I'm just enjoying sitting on the path that was laid out to me as I watched my brother die. That was my path in life. And knowing I'm just on the right path. And that feels really good.
You're listening to my guest, author and storyteller, story coach, and founder of School for Writers, Lauren Marie Fleming. And if you want to take a deep dive into, I don't know if it's deep, but the internet dive into Lauren's life, you can check out her website at laurenmariefleming.com. I don't know if Fleming naturally has two M's.
You know, I see it about half and half both ways.
Yeah. For some reason, I felt like I had to say it's one M, laurenmariefleming.com. So, at this moment, again, because tomorrow night you'll be at Cal Poly with a group of people that are actively, you know, excited about an interactive workshop, what is it that they can look forward to?
So I like to make sure what you just said, interactive. I am not a lecturer. I can talk, as you can tell, but I'm not a lecturer. I like conversations. And so my goal with everything I do is that we're interactive. I don't believe that I'm the expert in anything but story. Mm-hmm. I know I can confidently say, and I have the receipts to prove it, and I've got the client list to prove it, that I am one of the best in the world, if not the best in the world, at pulling people's authentic and empowering stories out of them. That is my genius zone. But no one knows you better than you. Mm-hmm. So with all that I do, I try to make sure that what I'm doing is giving you a space and the tools and to pull your story out of you. Instead of not telling you how to write your story, not telling you what to write, not telling you any of that, just really, what do I do to pull your story out of you? So we're going to start with understanding your why. Why do you even want to do this? Why are you even in this room right now? What even matters? And then we're going to go into what your goals are and break it down. Like, what's your big goal? And what does that look like broken down? What does mm-hmm. it look like in action steps? And then how do you build rewards into all of that? And how do you make it fun? And how do you build community? And I am absolutely going to make you talk to the people around you and tell them your goals, because you are the American Psychology Association I think I got that name right.
Psychological.
Psychological shows that you're 92% more likely to have a goal happen if you talk to others about it, if you tell them about it, and if you write it down. So I'm going to make people write it down, and I'm going to make them tell others about it. And then we're going to talk about what does it look like to hold the goal through the ups and downs. And that's building in reward. That's building in community. And that's building in and making it fun and making it about – I always tell people, make the ask the win. Don't make the win the win. Don't make the book being out in the world is great, but it hasn't really changed my life other than I just have a lot more people that get to come along on the ride. Mm. Like, it would not be worth it if I didn't bring my people along on the ride. That's why I did such a great, huge book tour. It's because I had people that were like, we've been in this since day one. We remember that dream of like, we've been here. Let's go. This is our win. And so how do you make a community gathering feel that like we're in it together, we're in community? And I think we spend so much time online and we hear all the things in the news and it can feel so overwhelming, but what does it look like to hold your goal and hold the person next to you's goal, mm-hmm. and work together to see like what it could be like if we all dreamed bigger and if we all built up resilience more together as a community?
Well, and it's interesting because in the American Psychological Association, they talk about resilience, and the very first skill they say to nurture is build community, mm-hmm. find a support network, people that cheer for you and you cheer for them. And having that is like the foundation of our resilience. So it's interesting that you're leaning into that piece. And then I also imagine that if you hadn't had the book published, because Fat Girl, if that had not been published, that you would still be okay, because the joy in building your life seems to be the thing that drives you.
I had to stop caring if I got a publishing deal because I couldn't get publishing deals. This was my fourth time going out to publishers in a 7-year period. It is not easy when you are writing about queer fat people. I had people tell me, you know, I had the top lesbian blog and the publishers came and approached me. I had columns and major things. I was a big deal. I had a huge following on MySpace, y'all. That was back in the day. but I was a big deal, and I couldn't get a publishing deal. And then I had a publisher approach me because my Body Love program got a lot of traction and was making it really big on the internet. And a publisher approached me. He's like, we want to turn it into a book, but you have to. Like, it is irresponsible for you to not include diet talk in it. And I was like, I'm not going to include diet talk in a book about profoundly loving your body. And that deal fell through. I had somebody who told me that they were taking Because Fat Girl out to publishers. And 9 months later, I was like, yo, what happened with the publishers? And they're like, actually, we decided, could you flip the genders for us? We don't like this. And like, I had so much rejection that I had to take away my idea of success and my idea of joy and my idea of like making it from that. And I had to just be like, am I still able to be a writer? Yes. And that is a win in a world that has told me that I shouldn't be a writer. Am I still writing what I want to write, like from my heart? I think it is a profound act when they are literally deleting everything about LGBTQ people off of the government's website to be publishing stuff more and more about LGBTQ people. And so I think that it is a profound act to just keep existing. I mean, this sounds really harsh, but like, have I not hurt myself today? Like, have I taken care of myself? Have I eaten well? Have I taken care of myself? Those have to be the wins. And so if the book hadn't come out, I probably would have just self-published it. This particular book, I wanted it to be it's in airports and bookstores everywhere. I needed it, but I would have just kept going because that's where the win is. The win is in the ask. The win is in the living the creative life.
Lauren Marie Fleming, thank you so much for spending this hour with me. I'm sorry it went so quickly, but if you want more of Lauren Marie, join her at Chumash Auditorium up at Poly tomorrow from 6 to 7 p.m. Wednesday night. You can find out more if you send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, but always thank you for listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I am not a stranger to the dark. Hide away, they say, 'cause we don't want your broken parts. I learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say, no one will love you as you are. But I won't let them break me down to dust. I know that there's a place for us, for we are glorious. When the sharpest words wanna cut me down, I'm gonna send a flood, gonna drown them out. I am brave, I am bruised, I This is me. Look out, 'cause here I come.